Welcome to the Florida Roundup, the statewide edition hour. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Melissa Ross is off this week. Thanks for listening. The floodgates are open with water flowing from the east and west of Lake Okeechobee. For the next 2 weeks, water will pour out of the lake. Billions of gallons of algae-infested water will be released to the east and west as the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers works to bring down the lake level. Now, as the water is released, it brings with it a bright green algae, fouling the waterways and marinas. This week, before the Corps announced its decision to release the water, Governor Rick Scott declared a state of emergency in seven counties surrounding the lake and its runoff after visiting the area earlier in the week.
You have to say, okay, well, make a decision. What do you think really is going to happen? What's going to have the biggest impact? And push your resources there.
The governor is running for U.S. Senate against Senator Bill Nelson, who also toured the region and then spoke about it on the Senate floor.
They're facing a problem that seems to repeat itself almost every year.
It certainly has been repeated just 2 years ago. The algae blooms are a reminder of just how interconnected the water of Florida is and how difficult it has been to find fixes and the money to address dirty water throughout the Sunshine State. So this is where we will begin this week's Florida Roundup statewide edition, again talking about dirty water, the big blue eye in the lower third of the map of Florida. Have you seen or smelled the algae? How does it affect you, even if you live far, far away from Lake Okeechobee? And what are the politics of this kind of pollution? Jill Roberts with WQCS, our sister station in Fort Pierce, is along with us. Amy Green covers the environment for our sister station, WMFE, in Orlando. And Mary Ellen Klass is the bureau chief of the Tallahassee Bureau for the Miami Herald with us from our sister station in Tallahassee, WFSU. Jill, let's begin with you. You're closest to the lake and where the floodgates are open. You visited some of these waters, I believe, earlier in the week. Tell us what the current situation is. Describe the scene.
Well, you know, I went in and spent a lot of time at Stewart City Hall yesterday, and they have, they're right on the water, they have a whole wall, two floors of windows that look out on this beautiful water. But as you're looking out on this beautiful water, you also see the signs there that say blue-green algae, don't come in contact with this water. And it's, you know, there are people who make their living doing these things. They were showing me pictures from the marina of the people who have to go into the water to help lift the boats. And they're just real concerned about what this might mean for their health.
The pulses of water being released from Lake Okeechobee are being done by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in an effort to bring the lake level down to help protect against any kind of breach or danger with the southern rim and the aging Hoover Dyke. The state of emergency declaration given by Governor Scott earlier in this week, Jill, what does that do?
That allows them to take advantage of some resources. That allowed the Army Corps of Engineers to maybe send the water some other places to hold it at what they're calling some water farms and not send it and actually stop completely the releases for a couple days. They have started, as you mentioned, pulse releases again. And the city of Stewart declared its own state of emergency, which also gives it some resources and the option to put up those signs and spend some money there.
Amy Green with WMFE in Orlando. Our colleague Jill Roberts there is on the east coast of Lake Okeechobee, but much of what she describes could essentially be a mirror image of what folks in Fort Myers on the west coast are experiencing, correct?
That's absolutely right. So what we're seeing here is the impact or the effects of water management decisions that were made in the middle of last century. you know, this is a result of Everglades drainage that has resulted in water flowing from Lake Okeechobee to the coastal estuaries on the east coast and the west coast. And so so certainly on the west coast, residents there could be facing many of the same problems. And as you mentioned, Governor Rick Scott was on the Caloosahatchee River earlier this week.
305-995-1800 as we get things underway, talking again this week about the bright green algae situation in Lake Okeechobee, how that is spreading to the east and west coasts, fouling up those waterways, but also water policy and politics in the state of Florida. 305-995-1800. Maybe you live tens, if not hundreds of miles away from Lake Okeechobee. Water politics certainly is going to impact state statewide politics this election cycle. 305-995-1800. Mary Ellen Klass is the Tallahassee bureau chief of the Miami Herald and the Tampa Bay Times with us from our sister station, WFSU in Tallahassee. Mary Ellen, always great to have you on the program. Talk to us about the politics of this latest incident of pollution. Lake Okeechobee and algae seems to be on the same general election calendar coming in even numbered years over the last couple of years.
Yeah, you're right. In the story David Smiley and I wrote this week, we described it as draining the swamp has suddenly taken on a new meaning. It really, you know, this is the kind of thing that has this visceral effect and impact and a reminder of the environmental relationship that Florida has, that voters have with the environment. And, you know, it's after the horrible toxic algae releases and the effect that had on shutting down businesses on the coasts and causing people to show up in emergency rooms with bizarre illnesses and children being affected by it, the politicians in Tallahassee, led by Joe Negron, decided, okay, we're not going to let this happen again, so we've got to put something in place. It was not an easy lift, even though this had this dramatic effect on people, on their businesses, and their lives. So it's as you've mentioned, it's a perennial issue. It's becoming a constant issue,
yeah,
but
right.
It's still not easy to find the solutions.
The one of the fixes you referred to there was the reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee that was championed by Joe Negron. Jill Roberts, Senator Negron, the leader of the Senate, for a couple of years, this was a defining moment for him as it affected his hometown. He is, stepping away from the power position that he has been in. But has he held any sway with the 2018 outbreak of algae?
Well, everybody's happy about the reservoir, and especially now that it's going to go to Congress to be approved, and they're going to expedite repairs of the dike. All of that is really good, but all of that is years away. And yeah. People are just saying, "What can you do for us now?" And there's just really nothing.
The federal dollars for the dike refer to Hoover Dike, which, of course, dates back to its namesake, frankly, from the 1920s. Amy Green, those federal dollars kind of fast-tracked in the last week or so between the White House moving quickly into Congress. But to Jill's point, it's money for to help keep the lake in its banks. It's not money to really clean the water that's coming out of the lake today.
Right. Mary Ellen Klaus made a really good point. You know, you're seeing state agencies responding. You're seeing federal agencies responding to this problem. But the unfortunate fact is, real fixes to this problem are really not going to be able to be complete for years and perhaps decades. You know, you're seeing, the federal government, offer some approval for, moving forward on that reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee, and Congress will probably have the opportunity to vote on that later this year. Also this week, you saw the federal government announced funding to complete repairs to the lake that surrounds Lake Okeechobee, and that'll make the lake safer for communities that live around there. And you also saw the federal government release draft plans for more water storage north of Lake Okeechobee in the Kissimmee River region, reservoir, wetlands restoration, underground water storage wells. But these are large projects. They require a lot of money. They require approval from the federal government, and it takes a long time. And so for residents who are crying out for answers now, the Governor Rick Scott's emergency declaration and some actions that the Scott administration has taken on this issue do provide some relief by creating opportunities for this water to move south, but real answers are still years away.
Yeah, water moves a lot faster than water policy and a lot faster than even politics here in Florida. 305-995-1800, talking about the politics of pollution and water here on the statewide edition of the Florida Roundup. To your phone calls, beginning in North Florida, Jacksonville, Emory on line one. Go ahead, Emory, you're on the radio.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I hear us talking about the pollution and how it's going to be a perennial problem, but it's the 800-pound gorilla in the room. We all know what's causing this. This is the agrochemicals and the sugar industry around the lake that's been dumping their fertilizer and the runoff into the lake for decades, and this happens every year. The power of big sugar in this state to use our water systems as their toilet is the problem. Why has no one got the guts to stand up to these people and keep our water clean?
Emory, we got it. Mary Ellen, let's talk about the role of the sugar industry, not only when it comes to the pollution, but obviously very active when it comes to politics.
Yeah. If you look at the trajectory of this issue, it's not new. They've been talking about, the algae problem seems to be something that we're seeing in recur more frequently mm-hmm. in recent years. We've had algae issues and outbreaks for decades. The solution to restoring the Everglades and dealing with avoiding the discharges has been something that's been on the plates of administrations at the federal and state level for three decades. And the consistent thing has been, I think, delay. We've had big press conferences. We had one back with Lawton Childs. We had one with Bill Clinton and Jeb Bush. We had another one with Charlie Crist when he was governor. Mm-hmm. And then Governor Scott even announced that he's going to, stop the lawsuit and we're going to make progress. But every time they move one foot ahead, they also manage to delay it. And the consistent power broker in those delays is often the sugar industry, which has the power to influence the legislature, because a lot of these solutions require congressional and legislative funding and authorization. And, back in 2000, when they had an agreement to reduce the pollution levels in the lake by 2015, what happened in 2015? The Florida legislature postpone that and gave them another 20 years.
305-995-1800, phone number, talking about green algae in Lake Okeechobee specifically, but broader water and policy and politics here in Florida. Coral Springs in South Florida, Broward County. Jeff, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
I appreciate your taking my call. I will start by saying my friend from Jacksonville stole my thunder. Big sugar, is heavily subsidized. It's a heavily subsidized industry, and they're taking essentially public dollars to lobby and get their way through on these issues. But that's not my main point. My main point is, if this is so dramatically affecting tourism, why haven't tourism officials in Miami-Dade, Broward, Palm Beach County, up the coast east, up the coast west, stepped up? Now, I know that Miami-Dade, Broward, Monroe, they aren't directly affected because the discharges don't go into their waterways necessarily, but they have been, their silence has been deafening, and they're conspicuous by their absence, and no one brings it up, and it's horrible that they won't step up and force this. Because if you compare big sugar or big ag as an industry to tourism in this state, I would hazard to guess that tourism dwarfs it. And if we lost tourism because people thought they were swimming in fouled water, watch what would happen. Our economy would tank. So
Jeff,
that's my thought.
Appreciate you sharing it with us. Jill Roberts, let me put it to you. You are right in the heart of the East Coast discharges. You're seeing the algae in your waterways. You've talked with the business owners and the government officials. Is the tourism industry engaged up there from where I am in Miami, in Fort Pierce, but there to the east of Lake Okeechobee?
Absolutely. I don't think there's a segment of the community here that is not involved, whether it's real estate, tourism. They are waiting to see the latest numbers for tourism rooms in the hotels at the end of this season. You need those numbers to back it up. I was at the hospital yesterday. They are just starting a a survey. They're going to ask, as they intake patients, especially patients with certain conditions, were you in contact with the water? Were you swimming in the water? Did you breathe the water? What is going on? So they are going to, they're in the process of collecting data. And if I could just back up a little bit, we're talking about the causes of this. And, and for many people, the causes are clear. But you have the experts here, the environmental experts, that don't agree. They don't agree on a cause. They don't agree
on... Tell us more about that.
On a solution. And it's so you have a lot of people trying to collect hard data that you can point to right now, because there are some scientists who say it is septic tanks just as much as anything else.
North of Lake Okeechobee that then drain into the lake, is that right?
Or even locally.
Or even
locally, our local runoff. And the nutrients, certainly there are things that are contributed from here. It's just not everything that comes from Lake Okeechobee. But it is the fact that the algae itself comes from the lake. But even if you could take a magic wand to make the waters discharge just as clean as they could be, you're still putting fresh water into brackish water, and it's still going to kill the oyster beds and the seagrasses.
Amy Green of WMFE, let me ask you a little bit about that science and the debate that Jill touches on, because we've heard that even, and Mary Ellen, we've heard it at the legislative level as well, where legislators north of Lake Okeechobee will talk about maybe septic runoff, or legislators south of Lake Okeechobee will talk about septic runoff and not Big Sur. So it's not any one thing that necessarily causes the environment to create the environment for these algae blooms. There's several contributing factors here. Is it your sense that there's a handle on that, though? Or agreement, at least? Consensus?
Well, let me just say, I'm not a scientist, but as I understand it, there are two main problems here. And the first is water management decisions that were made during the middle of the last century that restructured the Everglades, restructured the South Florida watershed to create a situation where, rather than allowing water to flow south from Lake Okeechobee into the Everglades and into Florida Bay, the water now is redirected to the East Coast and West Coast. And so that creates a situation, as Jill explained, where you have fresh water going into brackish estuaries, and that is damaging to the wildlife and into the ecosystem there. The other problem that we have is nutrient overload, and nutrient pollution comes from the state's exploding population. Residents moving into the state, fertilizing their lawns, using septic tanks, farmers fertilizing their fields. All of this goes into the Kissimmee River, which flows into Lake Okeechobee, which flows to the estuary. And just as fertilizer keeps our lawns green and lush, and just as fertilizer, nourishes croplands, it also nourishes these algae blooms.
Absolutely. Mary Ellen Klass, just 30 seconds here. Will this carry over into the legislative session, which is still months and months and months away, and an election away, too?
Well, the interesting thing is it's becoming a big issue in a lot of campaigns. We've watched the U.S. Senate race, we've got the governor's race, and the Ag Commission race. And because they are now kind of on the hot seat in deciding what they're going to do about this, I do think it will carry over, and I do think that they're going to have to follow up with whatever promises they've made.
Mary Ellen Klass, Bureau Chief at Tallahassee at the Miami Herald. Jill Roberts with us from our Fort Pierce partner station, WQCS. Amy Green from WMFE will stick with us here. We've got lots more to come here on our statewide edition. Thank you so much for listening. It is the Florida Roundup, statewide edition from Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Melissa Ross is off this week. Thanks again for listening. Yankeetown, Florida is a tiny town on the Gulf Coast that may have a big lesson for how communities can protect themselves against the threat of sea level rise. Now, over the past generation, sea level has risen about 6 inches in Florida. It's forecast to raise another 6 inches in half that time, and maybe as much as 6 feet by the end of the century. Florida is the most vulnerable state in the nation to higher seas. It's also where the state government banned using the term climate change in official business. Local communities have been left to make their own plans to protect themselves against higher seas. Miami Beach, for instance, has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on pumps and raising roads. But Yankeetown doesn't have the resources like Miami Beach. WMFE's Amy Green visited that Gulf Coast town.
Jack Schofield is Yankee Town's mayor. He gives a driving tour of the town.
Right now, we just left Town Hall, and we're going out one of the main roads to get out to County Road 40, 63rd Street. And this is really the heart of downtown Yankee Town.
Few coastal regions in the country are as unspoiled by high-rising condos and hotels as Yankee Town and its surroundings. Some of the longest-running climate change research anywhere is here, where protected lands such as the Withlacoochee Gulf Preserve have supported groundbreaking studies on the impacts on the natural environment. The town already is underwater, with city lines actually extending 3 miles into the Gulf of Mexico. More of the town's area is wetlands and open gulf than dry land.
Yankee Town may be tiny, but it is taking an unprecedented path to protect itself against the threat of higher seas. This is up next here on the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition. Your phone calls welcome at 305-995-1800. Have you seen actions taken by your community, your neighborhood? Would you like actions to be taken? 305-995-1800. Amy Green of WMFE is still with us. She reports on Yankee Town for the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. And Trevor Aronson is the executive director of the center. He joins us via Skype. Amy, we heard your kind of drive around town there with the Yankee Town mayor. Give us a broader description of the region that it sits and what its interest is in sea level rise.
Yeah, well, Yankee Town is just a gem of a place. It's situated in Florida's Big Bend area, which is in northwest Florida. And, you know, as you heard there, it's just a very undeveloped part of the state. And so that has made the area extremely attractive to researchers who are interested to know about the impacts of sea level rise and climate change on the natural environment. And so for decades, there has been some of the longest running research underway there. And Yankee Town is kind of right in the middle of that. It's a community of residents who have a deep passion. They care very deeply about their natural environment. And so they've taken steps to protect their community from development and also from sea level rise and climate change.
What are some of the results or some of the evidence of sea level rise and climate change that can be found around Yankee Town for those that are able to see it?
For some of the starkest signs of that are what scientists call ghost forests. And these are areas where the salt marsh has migrated inland and encroached upon forests, and the inundation is killing the trees of the forest. And so when you're out there, you can see these kind of bony skeletal remains of these tree islands that only decades ago were very lush with cabbage palms and sable cabbage palms and pine trees. Mm-hmm. And today, some of the stumps are being overtaken by the salt marsh.
Amy Green with WMFE reporting on Yankee Town, Florida, and the efforts this tiny community is taking regarding protecting itself against the threat of sea level rise. Her report is part of a partnership with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. Your phone calls, your comments, 305-995-1800. Trevor Aronson is the executive director with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. Trevor, what makes the story of Yankee Town remarkable among the features is it is using a state law that is not that old, even by Florida standards, that was not necessarily designed to protect natural areas from changes, but is being used in this way. Tell us about this use of the Natural Resources Adaptation Action Area. What is that, first of all?
Yeah, so the state passed a law that allowed for this zoning process called an adaptation action area. And this really came out of the South Florida Climate Change Compact and this idea that communities needed to look forward and then think about where are the assets that they needed to protect. And so what this really meant is infrastructure, you know, roads, water pumps, electric generation stations, power plants, essentially. And in planning for a future where we are looking at sea level rise, you know, what can the community do to make sure that those assets are protected in the event of terrible storms or a situation where the natural level of the sea continues to rise. And what we see adaptation action areas used in large cities such as, you know, Fort Lauderdale or Broward County, its county there. Mm-hmm. But what Yankeetown does in a very unique way is it takes that idea, which is to say, we are going to kind of wall off this area and make it so that development has to happen here in a way that is in concert with protecting this area. So when they do it in Fort Lauderdale, they're looking at protecting roads and infrastructure. Yankeetown essentially took that idea and said, look, we're going to protect our natural habitat, which is essentially a buffer for sea level rise. And so the idea being that when they're designing, you know, the future of the city, they'll keep in mind that, you know, the sea is likely to come in. And not only do they need a buffer to exist, but that buffer essentially will keep the sea at bay better than if they were to, you know, build, you know, a road or condos there, for example.
Yeah, so Yankeetown is thinking of, say, mangroves or sandbars or seagrass areas in much the same way that an urban area would think of a sewer line or an electrical line.
Absolutely. And if you think about how the development of Florida has come to be, I mean, I think you can raise questions about whether we should have been thinking the way Yankeetown is a long time ago, right? Like, I live in Pinellas. All of the barrier islands are fully developed. And those barrier islands were meant to be a natural protector of the mainland from storms and from sea level. And we see that throughout Florida. And obviously, we can't turn back the clock and change things. But I think what Yankeetown is doing is very forward-looking. And I think it's particularly interesting that it's coming not from, you know, a large city. This is coming from a very, very small Florida town.
Yeah, Amy Green, how did Yankeetown come to this place where it took this state law from 2011 that was really designed more for kind of to address some of the climate challenges of large urban areas and apply it to a very rural area?
Well, the genesis of this is kind of rooted in an effort to develop Yankeetown maybe 10 years or so. And this effort was not successful. The residents of the community kind of joined together to fight this proposed development, and they were successful. And so the process of that kind of caused residents to evaluate, you know, how much they value their natural environment. And so the idea behind this is kind of, you know, the natural environment, it can migrate inland, it can migrate upland, it can evolve as the seas rise, but it can't do that if there's development right at the edge. And so the idea is to create space for that evolution of the natural environment. And by doing that, you are fortifying natural protections against sea level rise that will protect Yankeetown, while at the same time, you're leaving space for Yankeetown, the community itself, to migrate to higher ground if that's necessary.
Now, I can just hear, you know, the folks that live in coastal areas listening to us say, well, Yankeetown has the benefit of not having, to Trevor's point earlier, to not having its coastal immediately on the water areas developed already. How could any of this apply to, you know, Jacksonville Beach? How could any of it apply to Miami Beach, Pinellas County, Collier County, Lee County?
Well, you know, one example is oyster reefs. You know, this is an industry that's economically valuable to the area. Oyster reefs, oysters cleanse the water. They're natural cleansers and improve the water quality of the water. Oyster beds also they slow wave action, you know, during tropical storms and hurricanes. And, you know, this is an example of, you know, a natural protector against sea level rise and climate change.
One of the interesting wrinkles in this, Trevor, is the politics. This law dates back to 2011, the first year of the Rick Scott administration here in the state of Florida. And the Rick Scott administration, as evidence through reporting from the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, worked considerably to strike the term climate change from agency reports from its environmental agency and elsewhere. So how are we to kind of apply those two bits of information together?
Yeah, so it's important to recognize that obviously there are policies that the Scott administration has pushed forward and worked on that essentially do allow for some accommodation of climate change. And in some ways, this is an argument over language, right? So what we reported in 2015, which, you know, of all of our stories in our 8 years of existence, was probably our most impactful and noticed because of its absurdity, which is that the Scott administration had essentially created an unwritten policy that said scientists and state officials could not use the terms climate change, global warming, sustainability, sea level rise was to be termed nuisance flooding, for example. Right. But what the Scott administration has done here is essentially given cities a tool to say, okay, look, the sea level is rising, and here is what you can do to make sure that when you're planning for the future, you can use this as a tool to say, let's kind of warden off this area to prevent development from making it at a greater risk of exposure to a rising sea. That said, though, that doesn't necessarily, and it doesn't create any money for the cities. It doesn't create any kind of federal or state funds that will come help in this way. So it really is a question of what states and local governments can do. I mean, I think what's interesting about this, and it wasn't necessarily intended this way, but I mean, what our series and Amy's story is the first in that series of stories that we're planning to release, you know, every month or so through the end of the year, that will kind of get at this question of what has been the effect of a lack of state leadership on this policy, on the fact that state leadership is not taking an active role and saying, hey, Florida, we need to deal with climate change and sea level rise. I mean, in some ways, what this shows is that the state has kind of abdicated that leadership role and basically said, okay, here's a few tools you can use, you know, have at it, guys, whatever you want to do on the local level. And I think what's concerning is that there are bright spots like Yankeetown finding really inventive ways to use the laws that are on the books to kind of come to terms with climate change. But, you know, climate change and sea level rise and all of its effects are not something that recognizes county borders.
Right.
You know, this
right.
is something that is a statewide issue. And what's interesting is that this is not something that, you know, the government on a state level is really working hard to address. And so, you know, what we want to do in the series, and it's a different type of series for us in that, it's not about pouring through records and finding kind of documents. Instead, we're kind of just trying to describe a very nebulous thing, which is, how do you show the effects of something that doesn't exist, right? How do you show right. the effects of the fact that there isn't a state policy? And there really isn't this larger state conversation to say, okay, guys, like, what should we do about the fact that Florida is, you know, the state most at risk for climate change?
That's Trevor Aronson, executive director of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. We're speaking with Amy Green as well from our sister station WMFE, who reported on Yankeetown, Florida for FCIR and for Florida Public Radio. You are listening to the Florida Roundup statewide edition from Florida Public Radio. Amy, how about the point that Trevor is making there in terms of, as you're looking at the effect of the lack of real state engagement, as you spoke with the mayor of Yankeetown and spent some time there, what was the general kind of local attitude toward other agencies, toward other state government agencies or county agencies or the federal government in regards to its effort to try to protect what it has in Yankeetown?
Well, certainly one of the questions that my piece raises is, you know, is it fair that communities like Yankeetown are not afforded the same protections as more metropolitan communities like Miami Beach? You know, Yankeetown is an interesting place in that it's politically conservative. A majority of Lee County voters supported President Trump in 2016. But this is a community that obviously cares very deeply about the natural environment. Residents there clearly can see the changes that are underway there as the seas rise. Things like tropical storms and hurricanes, many residents are uncertain of the connection there with climate change. Mm-hmm. And the science does tell us that as seawaters warm, those storms are poised to become more frequent and more powerful. A lot of residents there consider climate change to be cyclical. They talk about climate change as something that's occurred for centuries, which it has. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, it's warming and potentially could cool again in the future. So, you know, this paradox, this interesting paradox, really illustrates how deeply residents there care about their natural environment, that they would take these steps to protect their natural environment.
Do they think of the steps that they've taken and the conversations that they're having as responses to climate change, or do they compartmentalize it more?
I think the goal is to protect the natural environment from threats like development and also from sea level rise.
Amy Green with us from WMFE, Trevor Aronson, the executive director of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, releasing their first report in a series of reports that will look at the effect of the lack of state leadership when it comes to response to climate change here in Florida, the most vulnerable state in the union when it comes to climate change and certainly sea level rise. Trevor, as you look at the politics of this area in Yankeetown, as Amy describes them, and the local response that voters are essentially supporting of their local officials, are they making a connection at the ballot box beyond just the local leadership? Are they thinking about how these bigger issues are articulated and debated at the state level and at the national level? I think we lost Trevor Aronson via Skype, but Amy, how about it?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Trevor. We can hear you now.
Oh, I'm so sorry about that. In a sense, they're not making that connection, but it's a part, I think, unfair to say that so directly, because part of this is how we talk about climate change, mm-hmm. right? There's this conversation we can have about climate change, which is that, you know, human activity is causing that, right? And 97% of actively publishing climate scientists say that human activity, carbon dioxide output, plays a role in warming the earth, right? But, you know, there's also this conversation to be had about, you know, whether human activity is playing a role. These are things that are happening, right?
Right.
In Yankeetown, the sea is rising. And so what you can see, and I think this is very interesting, and Amy's story gets at this, which is that in Yankeetown, which is Levi County, it voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump, in turn, you know, appointed Scott Pruitt, a climate change denier, as head of the EPA. You know, this
Who has since resigned, we should say.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. So this is not an administration that has wanted to deal with the idea that human activity is causing climate change. And so in turn, maybe we should enact policies that, you know, curb our human activity that's causing that. But instead, you know, at the same time, whether we do anything for that, you know, Yankeetown is going to be affected by sea level rise, whether or not humans are playing a role in that. And I think what's interesting is here's a community that by its, you know, voting is saying we don't really buy this human activity aspect. But at the same time, we do see the effects of it here, the effects of climate change, and we're doing something about it. And so I think, you know, to me, that what makes that interesting is that there's also this possibility of a statewide conversation that says, okay, we're not going to deal with human activity, but let's talk about what we should do as a result of the changes that
the
are
evidence
happening.
And the effect that we see already. Trevor Aronson with us via Skype, Executive Director of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. Amy Green of WMFE, thanks for sharing your reporting with us here on Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, the statewide edition this hour. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Melissa Ross is off this week. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. The retirement fund for Florida's teachers, state, county, local government workers, university employees, it's been on a pretty good run. Its investments have made money 9 years in a row now. In the most recent 12-month period, preliminary data shows almost a 9% return from its investments, and that initial estimate is actually slightly higher than what it even aims for. So if you're a public school teacher, if you work for a county or local government, maybe work at a university within the university system in the state of Florida and have retirement money with the Florida retirement system, it's been a good run. The fund is invested in all sorts of things on behalf of public workers, stocks and bonds, real estate, private equity, foreign companies. Now, it's that last category that includes money invested in Russian companies sanctioned by the U.S. government, according to Politico Florida. If you're a teacher or professor or government worker, are you okay with some of your retirement money invested in companies targeted by the Trump administration? Earlier this year, the state teachers union asked the fund to dump stocks of gun makers after the Stoneman Douglas school mass shooting. It did not. What does the retirement fund own on behalf of Floridians counting on it for their retirement? 305-995-1800 all across the state of Florida. 305-995-1800. Matt Dixon is back with us now with Political Florida. He's with us from our sister station in Tallahassee, WFSU. Matt, nice to have you back. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about these Russian investments that you found in the portfolio of the retirement system here in Florida. First of all, how much money are we talking about? This is a massive, what, $160 billion fund? How much money invested in these Russian companies?
No, the fund where the Russian companies are housed is about a $90 billion fund, and there's roughly $160 million in funds with Russian companies, essentially Russian companies that are publicly traded on other exchanges, and the state has bought stocks and securities in those companies, and it totals about $160 million.
Right. And so the fund or the retirement system has what it calls this scrutinized companies list. What can you tell us before we talk about what companies are on that list? What does that mean, scrutinized companies? Why does this list even exist for these investment managers?
Sure. There's a scrutinized companies list that policymakers, the legislature, can agree upon and say, these are companies that we do not want to directly invest in. The state of Florida should not. Iran's on it. Syria's on it. Cuba's on it. And if the state, under state law, can't directly put pension fund money or can't invest in those companies, there is, however, an exemption for pots of money that are managed by outside firms. So, you know, money management firm that contracts with the state and manages money outside of sort of the, you know, outside for the state, they can have investments in those companies. So as a result, there is some investment in Russian companies that are on that scrutinized companies list that the state otherwise wouldn't be able to invest in.
Does the scrutinized companies list that the state investors have, does it actually include specific company names, or it's more about companies that do business with the country of Iran or that do business with Cuba or Syria?
No, it includes specific names. It's essentially a memo outlining specific companies. And the biggest one that there are others, but the biggest one that was in our story was Gazprom, the Russian energy giant, the state-run energy company that Florida has some significant investments in.
And those investments are then, it's on the scrutinized company list, so the investments are then decided by what, the third party, what would be, you know, the financial industry called the third party administrator or this outside fund manager that the state hires?
Yeah, that's correct. It's important to note, one, that none of this is illegal. The state is allowed to invest in Russian-owned companies.
Sure.
And two, that the elected officials that oversee these funds aren't sort of picking and choosing individual investments. There's just too many. It's you know, this is a $90 billion fund with, you know, thousands of different investments. So those are two points of clarification. But yeah, it's managed by in these cases, the sort of outside management firms that the state contracts with.
Gazprom and others that do appear inside the portfolio, though, have been companies that have also appeared on another list coming from another government agency, and that being the U.S. federal government, because of some ties that those companies have. Tell us about that.
Sure. Most of these companies have been sanctioned in some form or fashion, but most interestingly and most recently, there was an April round of sanctions from the U.S. Treasury Department that focused on a whole bunch of Russian individuals and Russian companies, and that was largely tied to election meddling and other sort of cybersecurity issues. And the majority of the companies on the list that we wrote about came in that April round of sanctions from the Trump administration's Treasury Department.
And even though the companies were sanctioned and faced sanctions on the part of the U.S. government, there is no U.S. law or directive from the White House that would stop any American investor from owning stock in these Russian companies, right?
No, that's correct. And even public investment funds, I mean, we found, you know, there's most public, large public investment funds that might interact with Russian companies or have some Russian investments. There's been pushes in other states, largely by Democrats, to say, we don't want to do this anymore. Sort of, and you mentioned what the Florida Teachers Union did here with gun manufacturers. Mm-hmm. Other states have said, we don't want to invest in Russia anymore. But that's only been a handful of states, and there hasn't been a very large push. So it's totally legal, absolutely.
Governor Rick Scott, within the last year or so, has made a push to against companies that are doing a lot of business with Venezuela, for instance, because of the economic crisis and the political crisis that has taken a hold there. But yet, I would imagine, Matt, that still falls, you know, kind of outside the state managers of the retirement system. If these third party, these independent managers make the choice that those are good investments, they could appear in the portfolios.
Sure, that's absolutely correct. And one thing notable, the legislature passed legislation this year urged by the governor to not allow the state to invest in companies that are doing business with Venezuela. There were none, so it was right. Sort of a statement on paper, but didn't necessarily move any dollars or cents. There are actual investments in Russian companies, and that was sort of the jumping off point for the research I was doing was Governor Scott and some other folks in the legislature have vocally directed how the state can invest their money in some countries. But, you know, there's one that has directly meddled in elections, including in Florida. And there was, you know, sort of been a silence about that.
That being Russia. Matt Dixon, reporter with Politico Florida, along with us. You are listening to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition from Florida Public Radio. Matt, we've got a few phone calls here. Let's get to them. 305-995-1800. Maybe you're a public school teacher, a university employee. You work for a state, county, city hall. Maybe you've got some retirement with the state system in Florida. Are you okay with your dollars partially invested in some of these Russian companies and other types of investments? 305-995-1800. We'll begin in North Florida for this segment. Julius in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Julius. You're on the radio.
Yes, I approve of the teachers investing to make money for their beneficiaries for the pension fund. But the only disagreement I have is that we should not invest in communist countries. We should be investing in America, and I hope they do that. I'll take financial off the year.
Oh, interesting. So yeah, instead of specific companies, they're talking about or specific countries, talking about just systems of government. Matt, imagine that kind of thing here. You would potentially take out whole swaths of some very large economies, thinking specifically of the Chinese economy and some of those Chinese companies that are available for public investment.
Yeah, as part of my research, I didn't tally up all foreign investments by the state pension fund, but there, I would imagine a policy like that would impact billions of dollars throughout the world. The state is invested in a long list of foreign companies, some of which are friendly, some of which are foes. So that would be a pretty impactful policy change.
Yeah, it would be. Fort Lauderdale is up next. Jonathan on line two. Go ahead, Jonathan. You're on the radio now.
Thanks so much. I just wanted to say I'm a public school teacher, and I believe in divesting from companies that are not supporting an ethical mission for society. I haven't been back to public since David Hogg protested it, and I want to make sure that my school board and my union know that I don't want to be investing my retirement savings, no matter what the return, in companies like oil and gas, like the gun manufacturers that are causing so much havoc in our society and for our long-term futures. These kind of investments are nowhere near sustainable.
Jonathan, we appreciate your input. Matt, when you hear from a school teacher like that, Jonathan, talking about wanting his retirement invested in companies that have an ethical mission, what kind of voice do the beneficiaries of the retirement system have in these choices?
I think generally there hasn't been historically a huge one just because there hasn't been any groundswell of people saying, you know, there hasn't been a large number saying we don't want our money going there, we don't want our money going here. So largely I think the investment funds, with the few exceptions of countries like, you know, Syria and Cuba that we had talked about earlier, have sort of been allowed to you know, invest how they see fit and invest on in ways where they can see the, you know, getting the biggest return sort of outside of any political or advocacy voices.
We have just a couple of seconds left here. I want to squeeze in one more call from Miami. Jamie, get to it quickly for us.
I was just inquiring about the whether it's pension or is it stock that's being invested in this, the variety of Starbucks.
Gotcha, Jamie. I believe you're talking about Matt Dixon with Politico. You're talking about stock owned by the pension plan. Is that right?
Correct. It's investments made in other companies that are publicly traded, which is would be stocks or other securities.
Right, and it could be foreign stocks, for instance, of these companies.
Correct.
It's not.
Yeah,
just
a lot of these companies are. Yeah, a lot of these companies are traded on foreign exchanges.
Quickly, Matt. Response from the governor's office. Response from the retirement system about your reporting.
The governor's office said they would look into it, which I thought was notable in itself. Hmm. Usually the governor's office wants to shrug something off. You get a more generic statement. So we haven't seen any follow-up or sort of concrete action. But the response was, I believe verbatim, it's not in front of me, is we'll look into it. And the the SBA didn't have a comment on it.
The SBA is the agency that winds up being responsible for the retirement system. That's right.
Correct.
You speak state government policy. I'll reinterpret it here a little bit for you.
Yeah, no, I apologize. We all get caught in acronyms occasionally.
That's do. Mistake. You live and breathe government policy and political reporting. Matt Dixon sharing his reporting with us from Political Florida with our sister station in Tallahassee, WFSU. Thanks, Matt, for coming back on the program. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That'll do it for the Florida Roundup statewide edition today. It is produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Kevin Mershart is the producer. Jason Sabka, our technical director. WLRN's program director is Peter Meritz. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos. You can hear more at aaronlibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling and thanks for listening.